Welcome, everyone, to our Lift Every Voice book club. And I am delighted to be back here with a wonderful conversation partner, Claudia Lovemeyer. And this month, we are delighted to be featuring this book, The Wild Land Within, Cultivating Wholeness Through Spiritual Practice by Lisa Colon Delay. And Lisa's here with us. She's an author who specializes in spiritual growth, healing, and transformation. She has a great podcast called Spark My Muse with something like 200 episodes or more, I think, when I went in to look. And I've been on the podcast a while ago, so that's a kind of a fun sort of history we have. And she's also a spiritual companion, a spiritual director, someone who provides that kind of care to others. So I love the way that that presence and that lived experience has been woven through this book. So, welcome, Lisa. It's delightful to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me. And it's always great to talk with you, Christine. And it's great to meet you, Claudia. It's really an honor to be here.
Oh,
Thank
wonderful.
you. Good to meet you too.
Well, let's just begin by having you tell us a bit about the journey to write this book in particular at this moment in time, in this season of your life. What prompted you? Because it's, definitely has a unique slant to it, which is I love. So tell us a little bit about that.
Right. Well, one of the things my editor told me is there's so much in this book. It's a good thing that you have sort of this thing to hold it all together, which is this analogy of the wild land within, because you put a lot in there. And the reason why there's so much included is because I really had been wanting to write this book for a long time, spiritual formation book, maybe since 2009. So that's why it's like, boy, she stuck that in there too. Wow. Okay. So if people ask me what the book's about, I say spiritual formation, woundedness, but also there's plenty of other things in there. And I really did want to talk about something that happens that doesn't get addressed in most spiritual formation books is that when we begin spiritual practice in earnest, I don't see many books, or if any, talk about actually it can get worse before it gets better. And that can be a surprise. It can bring up pain and bitterness, resentment, and then people think, what's wrong with me? Am I having a breakdown? Am I doing this wrong? And they put it on themselves as though that they're the problem, when this is what the practices tend to do. They tend to bring up the stuff we need to work on and heal. And I wanted to accompany people in that and also provide this book for directors and for people in groups to go through it together. Hopefully this doesn't get read in isolation, that it gets read with the support of community in a trusting environment where you can feel not alone in your suffering. And when these th practices are done and they come up, wait, that brought up something painful for me, that someone else goes, yeah, also for me too, and that's norm, that's normalized. I also think that there's plenty of spiritual formation books that I've read. The market is dominated, it tends to be by white male European people in the religious life. Usually, often, like my favorites have been Thomas Keating, Thomas Merton, Henry Nouwen. Those are all white men priests from Europe who I love, but that is just one tiny little segment of our population and of worldwide Christianity, of course. So I actually had a lot more that I wanted to include. 15,000 words got cut. So that just means we need to search for works by Black women, women of color, and we're better off that way.
Fabulous. I love it. And just before I pass it on to Claudia, can you say a little more about the title, The Wild Land Within? Because it
Yeah.
does create a really lovely kind of overriding metaphor with the climate and the weather and the terrain and
Yeah. So what I'm saying with the wild land within is I'm referring to all the unseen dimensions of us that make us who we are. It's a very real place. It contains all of our memories, our ambitions, joys, fears, places of wound, capacities for intimacy. It's a lot of what Jesus talks about in his parable about the soils. It's kind of this place of the soils in our heart. And it has in how I'm doing it in my rendition, it has climate, which comes from the influences and experiences of our lives and our childhoods and all the rest. And that particular climate, which is particular to us, has particular weather patterns. And these weather patterns I refer to are what the Desert Father Evagrius called the eight afflicting thoughts, which are quickly gluttony, lust, avarice, sadness or dejection, acedia, wrath, vainglory, and pride. And he didn't think of them as moral failings like the seven deadly sins. He actually thought of them as human vulnerabilities. And from a spiritual formation standpoint, that's a very hopeful thing. We're going to have them because we're humans, but we work on sort of preventing these things from happening, and taking over our lives through the spiritual practices and through intimacy with God.
Beautiful, beautiful.
Okay, you clearly, even by your examples, Thomas Keating, Thomas Merton, Henry
Right.
Nouwen, you are you know a lot about Catholic teachings, but
Yeah.
You also reference some things that you see more in the Eastern Orthodox Church.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, in my experience in the Black Church, desert mothers and fathers, that I heard none of that the
Right.
entire time that I was in the Black Church. I began to go, to more white spaces and at the vineyard churches, and that's when I first heard about stuff like centering prayer, and then it kind of took me on a journey. So, how did you come to learn about this Eastern Christianity and ancient Christianity as a Latinx woman raised by two Protestant parents?
Right. And two Protestant parents where my dad was trying very hard to assimilate to whiteness. So that's very important to the story, because my Christianity growing up was modern, American, white-centered, and Protestant. So it was extremely tiny, tiny. Not a single bit did I know anything about even Christianity, very much beyond the 500 years of Protestantism. That's kind of where Christianity, in a way, began. And it's just bizarre. But I went to seminary and I got introduced to some Catholic writers and I got introduced to the Desert Fathers and Mothers. And I was like, there's mothers? This is good. I like that. I like hearing that people regularly went into the desert places and they sought out women for wisdom and teaching. And I was very enthralled, and so I was fascinated and intrigued, and I went in, and these are not white people in the desert. These are Syrian, Egyptian deserts, and there's people from basically the Middle East, coming to these places and living out ascetic lives as hermits. And this was a period where in Christianity, up to a half a million people came out to the desert and this kind of escaped the urban centers of Christianity. Well, I just kind of fell in love with it. So yeah, no exposure at all. And I think that this is part of disrupting what has happened in America and in evangelicalism, is this kind of this stranglehold on what Christianity is. It's like, well, there's an entire world and there's an entire 2,000 years of Christian history. How about we talk about all of that too? And that's part of all of our heritage. So yeah, I grew up very sheltered in a little bubble. I was really glad that it's burst.
How did the people, how did your evangelical beloveds react to this? Catholic stuff.
Probably, yeah. Well, once I went to seminary, I think some of them were like, oh, is she going to be a pastor? We're worried. I'm like, no, not a pastor. That is such a thankless job. Forget it. But
I just wanted to insert, when I went to seminary, I called it white man school.
Yeah, I know. I know. It's like that's who's valued. That was true of my seminary too. And so I had to go much beyond the text. And I had people who were in a sense mentors to me who said, well, here's a book list you might like. And I had to really go outside of the book lists and make friends outside of the context too. You have to search because the algorithms don't favor people outside of whiteness. And sometimes it's not any kind of malicious intent for the professors. It's the water we swim in, and, mm-hmm. and it's poisonous water because it only benefits certain people. So we just have to make a point of disrupting these automatic systems and status quo.
Yeah. Yeah. That's spot
on. Did you get pushback? Did you get pushback?
The people who really love and support me, I guess I'm just a weirdo and people just expect weird things from me. I think there was probably some chit chat, but I just don't care. And I wasn't going to spend the energy on looking into it.
Do you want to say anything more about, you know, your father's role as a minister and how that impacted you, and particularly what you were just saying, like being indoctrinated into the kind of that white passing system?
Right. I think, let me see if I had a little bit of notes here. I think one of the things is maybe people don't realize is there's a lot of pressure for people of color. I don't know that this is really necessarily understood, but there is a lot of pressure, especially in Puerto Rico, which is a colony of the United States. It's not really treated with the same dignity or respect or laws that, mm-hmm. that is the rest of the United States. There's some privileges of being a colony that are good, but it has basically been set up to fail. And so really what happened, I think, in his case is he was came to Christ at a VBS that was by a missionary plant with white Baptists, fundamentalist Southern Baptists. And that's a very narrow thing. It's largely a Catholic country in general. There's Pentecostalism, there's Catholicism, and then there's some of the fundamentalists too. And this was in the 60s. And so there was this big push by this very fundamentalist strand to kind of push against Catholicism and the rest. And this is actually part of a cultural erasure too. So when you behave more white, you get rewarded and benefited. Mm-hmm. And the idea really is to be redeemed out of your culture. Mm-hmm. It's erasure. And it doesn't seem like that. It just seems like you're coming to Christ. But really, if you look back, you're being erased. And I think my dad found that out too late when he didn't know who he was. You know, he was just coming to the Lord, and he felt the power of the Lord. But he also felt a lack of self-worth, because who was he? Was he pretending to be a white person? You know, it was just really an interesting thing. And he did fall away from God and had a complete like deconstruction situation that really rocked our family and was very tumultuous. But I think it didn't help that there's this mentality that is imposed on the people of Puerto Rico and the Buricura, which is the people off the island who are Puerto Rican, but are maybe living in other places, mm-hmm. that the mentality is essentially white is right and white is better. And the more white you are, the more superior you are, mm-hmm. essentially. So this is kind of an unsaid, unspoken thing, sort of, and it kind of just gets into people's mentality. So when my dad would be preaching, he would also be preaching, you know, don't go to parties, don't dance, don't listen to your music, don't, you know, be as
don't
white
be
bread
too
as
Puerto
you can.
Rican. Yeah.
Don't be too Puerto Rican. Yeah. And he really bought it, you know, indoctrinated, believed it, and really, you know, but that left him with essentially nothing, because he wasn't, as a dark man, going to really be accepted. He would always be that Puerto Rican man. Mm-hmm. You see what I mean? He was never gonna, I can pass for white. And so people will say things to me that are blatantly racist, and they'll say, well, you know, Puerto Ricans, they're blah, 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 like this. And I'll go, oh, are they? Yeah. And I'll say, well, I'm Puerto Rican. And they'll go, well, not you. I mean, the other kind. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, I'm thinking the dark kind or people who don't act white. You know what? It's just there. And so, and I think people even mean well, they don't know what they're saying, and they don't realize that there's a preference for whiteness. And so that is very hurtful to people who don't look white.
Yeah, powerful stuff, Lisa. It's a powerful story. At what point did you start to break free from that? Like, did you start to see, you know, see what was happening and be able to reflect back on that? Because that seems like
years, because my dad passed away when I was in college at 44. And I was just in trauma because he didn't really pass away. He was in a nursing home in a vegetative state for 10 or 11 years. And so I was just dealing with losing him. And then I'd see him and I'd grieve him again. It was more than a decade of continual grief and not being able to move on. He wasn't gone. He would blink yes or no. It was just torture. It was hell. And so I couldn't think about anything except for my predicament right there. You know, I know, Claudia, I know grief. I know it. It's hard, and you're just where you are. You're just where you are, and you can't be anywhere else. Later on, I started understanding as I started reading more people of color. I started reading and I start, this is his life. This is his situation. I am adjacent to it. I don't have to experience it, but yet it is very close because I saw it all the time. I saw how people treated him. I saw how people spoke to him. I would often hold his hand as a little girl or even a 13-year-old, and we'd walk down the street and he would protect me by saying, oh, they think we're on a date. I didn't know what that meant. That meant that we shouldn't be together because we look too different. People didn't know we were related. I didn't have any idea what he was protecting me from. But I would say, oh, I didn't understand that. I was just like, okay, Dad, because he was always joking around. What he meant to say is, it looks like we shouldn't be together. Maybe I'm kidnapping you. These people are worried. You know what I mean? But I was always holding his hand because we were super close and I love my daddy. Yeah. You know, but I didn't realize there was all this racial colorism stuff going on, but it was all over. And later on, after I grieve my dad, I'm going, oh my gosh, I'm decoding all of it. And I'm going, oh, because to me, he was dark, but he was just my dad. I wasn't thinking in those terms. You know, I wasn't thinking he was other. He was my daddy, right? So I'm thinking later on, I'm like, oh, there was another. They called him Taco Joe at church. Why did they call him Taco Joe?
Oh God.
That seems... Puerto Rican people don't eat tacos, so that seems rude. Why would you do that? Well, like it's just like thing after thing. I was like, he didn't like when they did that. That wasn't endearing to him. They were just being like, you know, hey, dark guy, hey, Taco Joe. They would say, you know, are you really from the United States? Are you really a citizen? He's like, well, I was born in Brooklyn. And they'd be like, oh, but are you really? You know, it's just things like that where you know you're not in. You're not, you're the other one. So so it's close. So I think when I try to, I really make it my point to make sure that other voices are heard other than white people. I try to have a lot of people on my show that are diverse. And I can understand if people seeing me would be like, well, she's just trying to benefit her whiteness by doing that. But it is very personal to me. And, you know, when I got a DNA test, I was really, really wondering, what is this going to come up with? And I'm like, really excited. I'm related to probably loads of people are my cousins, because I found out that my DNA is all over the place. Like a lot of people in the Caribbean, there's African dysphoria there. And I have African ancestors, and I have Italian ancestors and South American ancestors and Caribbean ancestors and of course European ancestors. But I was like, wow, I'm kind of related to everybody. And I love it. I've got a lot of cousins. And so it's very personal to me that we disrupt whiteness. And I'm not talking about ethnicity. I'm talking about whiteness as the word of power. You know, it's fine to be German, Irish, French. You get into whatever your ethnicity is, but whiteness is a word about power.
Yeah, it's like breaking the lens that we're all looking through and saying, you know, there's another, there's like a deeper truth, you know.
Exactly. Because it's like the Matrix, and you got to take that red pill, you know,
Exactly. And
some of us don't even know we're looking through that lens. Because this is just how it is. And I guess especially living in America, which brings me to this. A lot of Black people have rejected our history in that we were captive Africans. We came here. We were not allowed to speak to each other in our own language. Mm-hmm. And also our spirituality was taken as well, but not completely. So we had this way of worshiping in those hush arbors that, you know, that the slave owners didn't even know about. But in contemporary times, Black people are rejecting this. And they're also doing things like moving into white churches, like mega churches. And even if the pastor is African American, the same model, you know, of behavior, it would be just like Creflo Dollar, but also he's just like Kenneth Copeland. And you know, so he's Black, but you're really not getting a Black experience when you go to, or when you look at him on television. So people are also leaving the Black church to explore their native traditions. And by native, I mean, you know, where they come from. So African-American people are getting into things like the African Yoruba religion. They just, they don't want the religion of the colonizers. So can you speak to that?
Yeah, it's totally understandable to deconstruct what has been painful. When I talk to people or work with people companioning, just start wherever they want to, wherever they are. I don't, you know, I think it's really actually quite important to deconstruct from any kind of colonizer or slaveholder religion, because it is extremely destructive to the inner person. It's set up to benefit the master, right? So it's a very individual journey. And I think I don't think there's anything wrong with going back to certain things that are meaningful in spiritual practice like that. So I would encourage people to find spiritual practices that are meaningful to them, that connect them to the divine. And there's so many hundreds of thousands of practices, things that can be spiritual. They don't have to think, well, if I don't read the King James Version Bible, I'm not being spiritual. Or, you know, if I'm not praying in a way I learned from such and such, I'm not being spiritual. I think that there's so many things that can be spiritual. Maybe there are some traditions from the African continent that can be integrated into your life that can be incredibly meaningful and connecting you to others and you to the divine. It could be going out in nature, creating art or music, taking an evening bubble bath. There, all these things can be spiritual things. And I think it's important for people to realize that God is not a Christian. Right?
I love that.
That's scandalous, Lisa.
That's not a Christian. God is not male, God is not white, God is not American, and he never, he, I say he, but she never was, they never were. And it's just important to break out of our boxes that we put up these constructs, because God doesn't. And I think it's great to disrupt these boxes, because the second we start getting God in a box, it's wrong, right? So I think God is, it encourages us, break out of the box. Yeah, I'm not a white guy. That's rude. Stop it.
You know, let me out.
I don't belong in this box, you know. And it's offensive to God to say, to assume that God works in these ways, and good, just blow up the box. I think now there's going to be people who have a hard time with that. Like, if you think everybody is fine and dandy, and you say, you know, is God a man or a woman? They'll say, oh, God isn't a man or a woman, but call God she and watch how many people lose their dang minds. You know, like, well, I thought it didn't matter. Well, it does now, you know? So yeah. I think we can't get too uptight about how people connect with the divine. If we accompany them in goodwill and we're safe place for them, I think that they can find, you know, I think it really is grounded in love, then we'll do so much better. So I kind of am supportive of people who deconstruct, as long as it's generative. Like, you deconstruct, but don't go off on your own and feel bitter and sad and isolated. Deconstruct, mm-hmm. but be with people who are generative and loving, and mm-hmm. try different things. My daughter is off to college now, and she didn't go to church all the first semester. And, you know, I would like her to get connected with a community of people, but I wasn't going to push it. And then she says to me, I'm going to go to church. I said, oh, really? Which one? And going to bring anybody? When she is ready, she can go. She can mm-hmm. pick where she wants to go. And I said, you know, what's fun about college is that you can try different things. You explore what God means to you and how you connect best. And that's kind of part of the adventure and the fun of starting out in adulthood, I think, I hope.
Yeah, that's beautiful to give that spaciousness and that freedom. I think that's what we all need is sort of the tension of that with, but also, like, she knows you're there, you know, you still provide the container for her. You're there if she needs to, like, lean into you. But yeah. But at the same time, to give, I mean, I'm not a parent, but that's my understanding of part of the job of, particularly when they leave home, and sort of giving them that, yeah, that balance.
I can't control it either. If she wants to, like, you know, be a Satan worshiper and sacrifice chickens, I can't actually stop her. But yeah. At the same time, she has to take a good look at what is being generative in her life, whether that whether it's her friends or her activities, or, you know, I hope that she has the tools. I can only just try to be there. We can't control our kids.
Yeah. I wanted to talk a little bit about liberation theology, because you have so many wonderful threads, you know, with the Desert Mothers and Fathers and Evagrius mm-hmm. and all of these. But I particularly to see Gustavo Gutierrez's name mentioned, because mm-hmm. when I was in college, I took a liberation theology course. I wasn't raised in a religious household, but it was really my doorway into discovering how Christianity could be something that was actually generative and liberatory, and, you know, that saw Jesus as the liberator, as the one to bring, you know, the genuinely good news to those who are suffering. And you talk about, let's see, in the anguishes of lived out realities, the lowly people can find God and can deeply rest in God, who cherishes them and meets them where they are, which is just such a beautiful, tender image. And particularly because our community is focused on the contemplative life and contemplative practice. So mm-hmm. I'm really interested in how does contemplative practice meet people in this terrible suffering and struggle, and what does it have to offer the world? And vice versa, how is contemplative life enriched by knowing the stories of that suffering and struggle? So it's a two-way conversation. So I just would be curious to know, like, what your thoughts are on sort of how contemplative life meets us in our pain and struggle, and particularly people who are marginalized.
One of the first things I'll say is the best way to know is to read my book exactly is to read Gustavo Gutierrez, because mm-hmm. he explains it from the context better than I will be able to. Mm-hmm. What he really is speaking of, and what I was writing there, is mm-hmm. that the people who suffer each day and wind up having early deaths because of oppression, poverty, and socioeconomic suffering, the people he's with in Peru, they cannot help but be under this thumb of oppression and suffering. And they are forced really to have a contemplative life. It's not really a choice for them, but they are experiencing the presence of God because they are so close to suffering in the way that Jesus identifies with us. In the same way, Jesus came as impoverished with no place to lay his head. And so the trust and reliance on God is there in every moment in for the next meal, for the daily bread. So the daily bread would be, you get paid once a day, and then you get your bread for that day, and then you don't know about tomorrow. And it's very similar for people in impoverished places like where Gutierrez is from. And so what he's explaining to us who have abundance, I'm not worried about eating tonight. I have a full fridge. And thank God I do. And I don't understand, even though I grew up poor and we had the government cheese and the free lunches, and I know what it is to be poor and only have, I only had new clothes when I was able to babysit and get my own clothes, but I was still able to eat every day. So I don't know what it's like to live in an abject poverty in a shack. I don't know that. And these people do that Gutierrez is involved with and identifies with in poverty as a person who's lives in bowed poverty as a monk. So what he's saying is that these people, if we understand where they're coming from and identify with them, we will understand that how they suffer in unique ways that brings the contemplative life into everyday regular life. And that shows us how the contemplative life is this experienced way of living with God that will benefit everyone if they do it. But for these people, it is the sustenance of being for them. And so he's really explaining a way of life that we don't understand coming from abundance here. And so I can't explain it so well, but Gutierrez can, and it's a moment by moment thing. And so what we can do in our context of abundance, it's very difficult for us to really get it because we don't live on the absolute precipice. Now, some people do. There are people who are homeless and they're struggling and they have mental illness, drug abuse, and they are really struggling day to day to get what they need. Some of them will understand the contemplative life and some won't. It's not like everybody in poverty just gets this or is close to God because of poverty. But what he's explaining is don't think that because people are in poverty that they are far from God. Sometimes these are the most faithful people experiencing the most blessed life with God, but it is a terrible struggle for them and their poverty should be alleviated. So what he's talking about is that Jesus is the liberator and we should be doing everything to liberate people from the system. So disrupt the system, turn it upside down, make sure that you're not just saying, oh, that's really sad for you. I'm praying for you, but you do things to make it right. Bring alleviate the suffering in real ways in the real world. So he really is speaking almost a foreign language to us. Even if we're reading it in English, it's going to be almost sound like a foreign language to us because we live in such abundance.
Yeah. And that phrase, the preferential option for the poor, which I've always loved. And I think it's hard for us to, for those of us who have abundance, hard to understand, even if we agree with it. Do you know what I mean? What that means.
Yeah. Right. It's a soft spot in God's heart. And that's why God in the incarnation comes as a oppressed person of color who is in poverty and is killed by the empire. When God decides to come, God comes as the most oppressed. And we are living in a Christianity of empire. And that's what I think a lot of people miss is that we're getting all the benefits of empire Christianity most of the time. Yeah. Who does God come for? Who is the good news for? It's for the people who don't have and the people who are not part of empire. You know, so I think that's what we have to get in our minds. We have to remember that the kingdom is the upside down kingdom. Mm-hmm. And in this way, we identify with the poor. We do what we can to help. And maybe it's just a simple ways in our neighborhood or something like that. It doesn't mean we have to solve every problem in the world. But we do have to identify with the poor in the sense that that is when Jesus said, you know, I was hungry and when did you feed me? I was thirsty. When did you? That is really God saying, I'm in those people. That is where my heart is. So,
yeah.
Make sure that you realize who the kingdom is about.
I just want to say, preach it, sister.
I can't even help it. I can't even help it because once you read liberation theology, it can really get in your head and switch it around. And you're like, oh my goodness, we're getting it all wrong. Like you feel empowered to make sure that people understand the blindness that can happen in the Christian church in the United States. Like it's not that we're all always doing everything wrong. But there is a certain kind of blindness that equates blessing material blessing with God's favor.
Yes.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You're really shamed if you're poor. And,
yeah.
And instead right. of supported, you're shamed. And like you said, you're blessed if you have a lot. The more you have, the more blessed you are, the closer you must be to God. So what we're getting is that God has a preference for the rich.
Right. Or the opposite. Exactly. Yeah. And I think Jesus over and over says who the good news is for. When he reads out of Isaiah, he's talking about the poor. When Mary says her song, she's talking about the rich go away hungry, the bellies of the poor are filled. And she's inaugurating this kingdom where everything changes in the last or first. You know, it's over and over in the Bible, but we're kind of like, you know, a little blind to it, I think.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All right, let's get to chapter 5. And I'm going to read a passage that's on between page bottom of page 82 and to 83.
Yeah.
And this is Evagrius. How do you say that? Evagrius?
Evagrius, usually. I think okay. so.
Evagrius says, before we can contend with our inner weather, and then he goes on to tell us that we have something else to handle first. The primary affliction to deal with prior to considering the 8 afflicting thoughts is the love of self. You went on to clarify that he's talking about selfishness and self-preoccupation, as well as centering ourselves in our stories. So could you tell us what centering ourselves in our stories looks like? And then we'll talk about my experience as a Black woman.
Yes, thank you. And I really thank you for asking this, because I'm happy to underscore this can be a little bit of a tough point. He was also speaking to the people coming to him out of the city centers and into the desert. So these are also people who might be coming for righteous reasons, and maybe they think that they're, you know, holier now that they're coming out there. So he's kind of saying, listen, before we get started, you know, don't act like you're really great. Okay. Like don't, you're not like super special that you're out here now. So some of this has to do with a selfish ambition and a selfishness, which causes us to be bad students or stiff-necked and stubborn. And we can all be like that sometimes. We think, I kind of smell great. I kind of know what I'm doing. But that gets in the way of us sometimes. But the thing I wanted to underscore is that if we have issues of self-worth, if that's already a problem for us, ego isn't a problem there. It's actually damaged self-acceptance, self-worth, and sensing your belovedness is a central problem and a central wound. Then it's not so much the selfish ambition is going to be a problem to make sure you get yourself out of there. It's actually more of a repair that needs to happen in your life. And metabolizing that you are the beloved of God is completely different from, you know, thinking you're too big for your britches. Is it really a different thing? So once we metabolize that we are the beloved of the Almighty God, it isn't self-aggrandizing. It's kind of like humbling and like, ooh, I feel okay. I'm refreshed. I feel like I have resources to love others. That kind of metabolizing of this belovedness doesn't make us haughty and egotistical, but that is what Evagrius is trying to say to people. Now, don't think because you left your family behind and you're coming out to the desert for a special ascetic life that you're all, you know, you're holier than the family that you left behind. Get rid of that notion before we can even deal with anything else, because that cannot come with you out here to the desert. So he's kind of saying, dispatch that, and then we can get started, because you're not teachable yet. So there's kind of this distinction there. For our time, it's not as potent, because there's hardly any of us going out to the desert to be ascetics and live this vocational life in the desert. But we can learn to be good students and have a kind of a teachable spirit and things like that. But it is important, I think, to make sure that we do work on sensing that we are the beloved of God. And if that's all messed up, it's going to be so hard for us to really sink deeply into the practices to love others in a way. When it says, you know, love others how you would love yourself, sometimes I think it's kind of like love others as you would want them to treat someone that you love.
Yeah,
because we're not ready yet, because we are an enemy to ourselves sometimes.
Yeah, I find it complicated even to regard myself as the beloved, you know, God's beloved, because as a Black woman, and I'm only speaking from the experience of a Black woman, we are regarded in the larger culture as ugly, as, you know, our hair is the wrong texture, and our bodies are less desirable, you know, like Kim Kardashian goes and gets a plastic surgery, but my butt is not, it's not right.
Yeah, there's a fetish, right?
Yeah,
loving.
Yeah. So, you know, we get all of these affronts to our dignity regularly. It's all over the media. Yeah. You know, you go to a beauty supply store and you see every manner of hair texture, and maybe a little section of something for people who wear their natural hair.
Yeah.
And so we've got all of these wounds that go all the way back to slavery, when, you know, our mothers were raped and our children were taken away and we were forced to breed like animals, which, you know, that's the whole concept of chattel slavery, you know, that you're property. And in many ways, I'm going to treat you worse than we treat the animals.
Right.
So we've got all of this, you know, that's a part, it's really in us. It's like it's in our DNA.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe we can have like some intellectual idea that we are God's beloved, but we're not anybody's beloved in the culture. So I just thought that was really challenging.
Yes. Yeah, I think you're right. It's very deep wounds. It's very, very deep wounds. And it's not like, you know, oh, I can heal. I can quickly heal from that. It's, I hear you.
You know, I think, Lisa, maybe this would be a good time to pause and move into a spiritual practice, to have a bit of an experience right now, you know, talking about the woundedness, and I'm sure a lot of people listening will resonate with some of that, and just to move into that grace and, yeah, give ourselves a little sacred pause, if you're willing.
Sure. I think one of the things we need when we're healing, we all need this, and is to make sure that our healing process involves some form of embodiment. That it isn't just in our head, we're thinking, we're healing, talking it out, because most of our wounds are non-lingual, and they're offline, and they're not in a chronology. They're always in the present. So our trauma is always in the present. And that's why when we think about healing or resting in the presence of God, if we can have it be embodied, all the better, because healing has to happen in the whole organism of ourselves. And so maybe what we can do is for a moment, just put our feet on the floor, put our hands on our legs, and feel the organism of ourselves, feel the warmth of our legs, feel the floor beneath us, and feel the size of our body, our beautiful body that God loves and made for us. And just breathe with a divine breath, and is glorious enough that God would incarnate the flesh of us, and just be doing a little bit of a scan down our bodies to feel if there's any tension that we're holding, perhaps in our neck or our head, working down from our head down to our shoulders. And as we move to our shoulders and our chest, to see if there's And he held breath, waiting to exhale and breathing in deeply and breathing out. And remembering that new life and new breath can come together. And that when God gives us breath, it is divine. And that that divinity is part of us. And we are one with God. And because God is holy and good, that we must be holy and good as well. And that nobody can take that from us. If we could just breathe in deeply and exhale and feel our body and feel that our thoughts are coming down and settling down lower, and we can feel the presence of our body and feel that it is here and that it is right and that it is good and that we love on it. And just breathe in and exhale. We might have to forgive ourselves for not loving it. And just as you scan your body for any tension, you can just acknowledge that it is there. You don't have to fix anything. You can just be in the spot where you are. And we know that people will project on God and on other people what they want, but that God will always bring us back to God's self and our belovedness. We could just breathe in a little, breathe in and exhale all of the tension from the body and invite God in to those places with that breath. Exhale the tension and give ourselves whatever time we need for that tightness to be expelled. Receive whatever we need from God. Lord, I ask that with every breath that we breathe, we can take in more of your goodness, more of your holiness, more of our belovedness, which is our birthright, which is part of how you made us. May you redeem us with your beautiful breath into our beautiful bodies. Amen.
Amen. That was very uncomfortable. For me, as we began to go into our body immediately, I felt defensive, like, I can't.
Not ready.
All this pain is going to come out if I start deep breathing, you know, like I felt like, no, I got to keep this pain in my body. Because I can't deal with it here.
Right. Yet. Right.
So I really felt the protective mode. At that.
Yes. Everything's very, very raw right now.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah.
I don't know if all of our viewers know that my son died of an overdose 3 months ago. I don't feel ready to. My body is tightly, desperately trying to keep all of this pain from leaking out.
Do you feel if it gets out, are you afraid it'll explode? What are you afraid of most?
I'm afraid it will just take over, and that I will never feel like myself again. I know losing a child changes you, or losing anybody, like your father, you know, it changed who you are. But I don't know, maybe it's so early that I feel like if I let it out, I'm never going to come back from it.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'll always feel that way, but I did, you know, because, you know, maybe most people were really relaxed and letting go, but maybe some of us aren't.
Right, exactly.
In an exercise, like, what, it didn't work.
Right.
For me.
Yeah. And it might be that for you to feel embodied first, you might have to do something much more active with your body, like lifting hard weights and something much more robust, that you might need to shove things and throw things and take a really sweaty walk, you know, or like, I think that it'll still be an embodied thing for you probably, but it might not be a nice calm down thing. That's probably not time yet.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, I know when I was going through grief, one of the things that was helpful for me was to have like a time during the day, like 10 minutes, 20 minutes, where I just let the grief completely go. And I know that you're having those times of wailing, Claudia, but you know, just to, I think sometimes like we're walking around holding it all in to try and preserve ourselves just so we can survive, you know. Yeah. And there also have to be those like spaces where we do let it out, because otherwise it's just gonna dissolve everything inside of us.
Yeah. And the expectation is, you know, you're so strong, you know. Yeah. I gotta be a strong Black woman. I'm not feeling strong. You know, I feel beat up on.
Yeah.
And you know, where is the space for a Black woman to lament and to keen? Yeah. I don't know where that is.
Mm-hmm.
Even in church, mm-hmm. you know, we just don't have that embodied way of worshiping in the same way. You know, if I were in the hush arbor, I could wail and scream. Mm. But there's no place to do that.
Wow.
Yeah.
You're right. I think it's so intense. Your body, you're holding it together, because if you had a chance, it'd be big, right? But whatever it is that you need to do it. So that might mean throwing, you know, falling out, throwing a fit, doing the thing you need, and whatever environment that could be safe in. It might not be church, but
The day after my priest came over to pray, and I had this sense that I just wanted to scream.
Right.
And I have a very mentally ill son. He jumped from the top of a 6-story parking structure. He survived, but was a very traumatic few years. Mm. And during those few years, and you understand this, Lisa, from grieving your father again and again and again, like losing him over and over, you know, I constantly had this urge to scream.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't. Mm. So this particular day, you know, it was so hard. And I felt that urge to scream. So Father Norman was praying, and my friend Lisa was just kind of bearing witness. And I just started screaming and kicking my legs and, you know, and they were just like holding space for me. Mm-hmm. You know, just let it out. Just let it out. But, you know, 3 months out, you know, it's like, I can't scream. You know, people are on Facebook expecting me to be strong.
Mm-hmm. No.
You know, and my daughter, she always like, even if I cry, she, you know, Mom, you got to remember he's in a better place. She like tries to mother me and to make me stop crying.
Yeah, sure.
But then you feel like you have to take care of her. But see, all the energy you're using to hold it in, absolutely exhausting. Absolutely exhausting. So that makes you want to scream more, because it's too much. It's too much.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, you need what you need. You need what you need. It doesn't matter about the time. There isn't a timing kind of thing with grief. It's just what it is. And I don't know, you know, there isn't like some answer of obviously, but I hope that you give yourself whatever permission you need to do whatever you need, as long as it isn't, you know, going to harm a person, but that what you need is what you need.
Yeah. 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 And maybe
really
to find
the throwing or doing something much more physical, because I didn't even know until we did that practice how I would, I didn't know that I would react that way.
Yeah.
And I can already feel if I can release, you know, in this really big, you know, maybe I won't have to scream.
Yeah. Like maybe you move furniture today. Take your couch and just shove it across the room. And there's got to be something that you can do that is feels like really hard work. And you just, as you're shoving something, you just let it out. And you just, because I think that our body is begging to feel something. It's stuck in there. It's stuck.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, you're a whole organism and it gets caught up here, but your body's like, I gotta get this out. And so I hope that you find an embodied way. It might be screaming, but it also might be punching something. It might be kicking something. You know, I hope something's soft enough that won't break anything, any bones. But I think it's really important that you, you know, get on the floor, throw an absolute fit. You know, it's...
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing wrong with you. There's nothing wrong with you at all.
Yeah. Yeah. And also to really honor, Claudia, what you were sharing before about just carrying like the DNA of, you know, women who've been had all this grief and sorrow as well. And that, you know, sometimes it's like we're the ones that end up having to process generations and generations of grief because nobody before us has had that opportunity. You know, whether we're a person of color or not, but then given that layer of experience, you know, it's just, I think so, to really go gently with yourself, but also to know that you're carrying things on behalf of so many. Yeah.
Thank you so much for just saying the truth and just being vulnerable and just saying that. There's, you're not putting on any pretense and facade for us. If people are listening to this, people are going to find resonance with that. I haven't been brave enough to say that or be truthful enough with myself to say what I need. I really need something more than just deep breathing. It's not working for me.
No, I feel like it, that was a very alive moment there, and I'm grateful to you too, Claudia, for being willing to share, you know, that no, this doesn't work. What do I this is what I need. Well, we're coming to the end of our time, and I just want to ask Lisa, what is the next on the horizon for you? Are you dreaming of more books to write, or, you know, what is your, are you working on a current project besides obviously promoting this wonderful book that everyone should be reading?
I'd like to say that on February 27th at 7 p.m. Eastern time, I'm going to do the whole book as a group, you know, every single week on a Sunday. So if anybody wants to come to that, you can go to sparkmymuse.com and find a link to sign on. I would love to just journey with people together through the book. I haven't done that yet. And people are saying, I'm waiting for someone to do this with. So I was like, I'm someone and we can all do it together. And then the other thing, I am writing another book, and it's on Renee Girard, which is a really known person who talks about mimetic theory, which is essentially that we are imitative creatures and we only desire, aside from our needs for food and water and basic connection, we only desire what we want through other people. And this mediated desire is what causes our violence and causes all kinds of issues, both good and bad. And I feel like I've been handed the decoder ring on a bunch of things. He also goes into scapegoating and why that happens and how Jesus is the ultimate scapegoat that reveals our violence to ourselves, and talks about what God is about in terms of love and in terms of ending violence. And so I'm kind of knee deep in research for this, but I'm really hoping that it unveils the kingdom of God in a new way, and we stop thinking in violent, mimetic, imitative ways, because that's our default.
Well, it sounds incredibly powerful, Lisa. I love the perspectives that you're bringing onto Christian practice and liberation and all of that. And I will include, if you send me the link, I'll include the link for your book, okay, your book study, because that's also, sure, would be wonderful, I'm sure, for many people. Thank you. So thank you, Lisa. It's been really fabulous to talk about The Wild Land Within, our February featured book. We're very excited to share this with our community and grateful for all your time and your wisdom, really, really. I feel like I've had a session with a spiritual director, which I have. So, you know, it's just nice to feel it that way.
Thank you so much, both of you. I'm really, really grateful.
As are we.